Welcome to the EDUCAUSE 2009 Annual Conference Podcast. The EDUCAUSE 2009 Annual Conference brought together the most influential IT decision makers and resources to improve the ability of higher education to achieve its mission. This podcast is sponsored by Juniper Networks and Quest Communications International. On this podcast, we feature our full interview with Jim Collins, author and lecturer on business growth and leadership. Our interviewer is Bill Hoag, Vice President for Information Technology and CIO at the University of South Carolina.
I have Peter Drucker open right in front of me. I wish during my graduate school days that I had had an opportunity to talk to people more about Peter Drucker, but he was not on any of my reading lists. I know that the case in a number of academic environments. And what was most powerful to me about 15 years ago was the first time I read his piece about effectiveness as something that must be learned. And so I since you mentioned Peter Drucker as an influence on you, I wonder if you'd take a couple of minutes for our listeners and talk a bit about Peter Drucker, your relationship with him, and how his work and his personality may have influenced your own path.
Well, it's actually the 100th year since Peter was born. This is his centennial year. He died a few years ago, but in the course of his years, he had, as you know, just a tremendous influence on the way the world thinks. And I'll kind of speak at a very large level, and I'll speak at a relatively micro level, a personal level about Peter. In terms of a very large level, I always like what Bob Buford said about Peter Drucker, and I the more I think about it, the more I think this is really true, that Drucker contributed as much to the triumph of freedom and to free society over totalitarianism as anyone. And the reason being that in order for free society to really function, the only way that free society and its great melee of kind of inefficiency brought about by democratic processes, the way for it to function, the way for it to be a competitive alternative to totalitarian regimes, is that we have to have high-performing and self-managed organizations, institutions of all types spread throughout society. And those institutions, in turn, depend upon excellent management. And that is what Drucker contributed, was the observation that you need effective management for these institutions to be well-run, and for them to be well-run is what we need for us to have a functioning free society. And he was really the first to put that whole chain together and then to articulate very clearly what it means to effectively manage. And so in that sense, I share the view that Drucker had a gigantic and to some extent unseen shaping hand. My own relationship with Peter's ideas and then influenced by Peter Drucker came first from afar. I had been doing with Jerry Portis the research at Stanford on what became Built to Last, and we were looking into the history of what made a lot of these great companies tick and their evolution, if you will. How did HP evolve? How did Merck evolve? How did Johnson & Johnson evolve? How did GE evolve? How did P&G evolve? How did these companies have the ability to grow and prosper and then to endure? And one of the things we found as we were going through the archives and the history and the evolution of these companies is that at pivotal stages in the 20th century, the people building those companies had been tremendously influenced by Peter Drucker. And so he was like a shaping architect behind the scenes of a number of the most important institutions, certainly business institutions. And so I really began to appreciate his influence through the lens of how he shaped those who build enterprises. And then personally, in 1994, I met Peter at the introduction of a mutual friend, a fellow named Tom Brown, and Drucker very kindly invited me to come and spend time with him. And so I made the pilgrimage to Claremont, spent time really interacting with him about a lot of different things. He asked me a lot more questions than I had a chance to ask him. And he was just so warm and so gracious. I mean, here you are meeting one of the greatest thinkers of the 20th century and the greatest management thinker of all time. And he brings you into his home for a conversation where he is clearly first and foremost interested in and concerned for you. I'll never forget, he was not just a great thinker, but he was really first and foremost just this remarkably compassionate and warm human being who I think in many ways that was the secret of his ultimate influence, was he was deeply concerned. He had a very large question he always wrestled with. What does it take to make society not only more productive, but also more humane? And I think I saw that up close and personal, one-on-one. And I saw that in the way that he wrote about these gigantic sweeping ideas and tectonic shifts that he was able to identify and articulate. And for me personally, it was just 2 days after the EDUCAUSE or 3 days after the EDUCAUSE event, I had the privilege to keynote the Drucker Centennial event in Claremont. And it was a very meaningful visit for many of us there because of the influence that he had had on our lives, and I could see in hundreds and hundreds of other people there whose lives he had significantly affected.
During your talk at EDUCAUSE, you talked about the great hope that you place in the younger generation, and in particular, your admonition to us as IT leaders that we get young people in our faces. And that if I'm not mischaracterizing what you said, your sense that the emerging generation may in fact be a great generation. And given your comments about how Drucker took personal interest in you as someone who was a much younger generation than he was, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what you see in the coming generation, and also what we, who in many instances are moving into the latter stages of middle age, might be able to do in turn to help nurture that growth of that next great generation?
Well, that's a nice question. And first, I believe that there are many great generations in American history. So I don't think that there is ever only going to be one great generation. And I think one of the remarkable things about American history is our capacity to create generation upon generation of great generations, if you will. That said, I believe that there is something quite inspired about this generation. And I the chief of staff of the Army made a comment at one point at a session I was at West Point that he felt that this was the most inspired and inspiring generation to be coming through West Point perhaps since 1945. And I don't know if that's true. What I do know is that as I interact with this young generation, they have a tremendous commitment to collaboration, and they take it as a given. Not as a possibility or a nice to have, but as a given that they should always, throughout their lives, be thinking not just about their own situation, about their own success, but about something larger than themselves and the way in which they contribute back to the way the world works. And I think that this is certainly perhaps distinctive from my generation, which we tend to think of it as, okay, maybe you get to that later in life, but it's not necessarily something that is integral to your life every step of the way. And I think this generation really has that. That said, I think that where we can be helpful to that next generation is to we're gonna need to help them have confidence that they can continue to be useful when the world is going to be so unstable relative to the last 30 years. I think that we're going to return to prosperity. We know how to do that. But what is unlikely to happen again is, it might happen, but I think it's unlikely to happen, is the kind of combination of prosperity and stability that really marked the last three decades. You had the rise of two superpowers and then one. You had an almost unbroken run of prosperity. Sure, we had a couple of recessions in there. We had a setback after 2001, but basically it had been a pretty steady climb. So you had stability and you had prosperity, and this is what they've grown up with. It's going to, in all likelihood, be a much more unstable and uncertain and perhaps difficult future for at least a period of time. And so what we need to do is to help them see that it is their very idealism combined with the very hard-headed Stockdale paradox that we write about in Good to Great, of having faith in your ability to prevail but combined with your discipline to confront the real stark realities that you face today, and to put those two together. I think that if we can help the younger generation embrace the Stockdale paradox while never losing their ideals, we could be useful to them.
That was a very powerful part of your presentation. Just for our listeners who may not have been able to attend your presentation, could you give a very quick recap of the Stockdale paradox?
Well, the Stockdale paradox is, for me, one of the more powerful ideas to come out of the Good to Great research. And it actually came from Admiral Jim Stockdale, and it was a pattern recognition of something Stockdale had said that then we really saw in the way our Good to Great leaders went about dealing with difficult circumstances and dealing with transforming their enterprises. And the essence of it is that Admiral Stockdale, who had been the highest ranking military officer in the Hanoi Hilton from 1967 to 1974, he'd been shot down, and he had the burden of command responsibility in the camp and also just the challenge of getting through it himself. And when I asked Admiral Stockdale how he didn't get depressed in the camp, he responded that he had never wavered in his faith, not only that he would get out, but that he would turn it into a defining event of his life. And then later when I asked him, okay, who didn't make it out as strong as you? And he said, the vulnerable ones were the optimists. And when I asked him to explain, he said that you should never confuse the need on the one hand for unwavering faith that you're going to find a way to prevail in the end, and you will turn any difficulty into a defining event. But you cannot confuse that end game faith with the need and the discipline to confront the most brutal facts, whatever they are. And you cannot delude yourself that you're going to be out by Christmas, because you might not be.
Thank you. I want to be very respectful of your time, and I realize that 15 minutes has already whizzed by. Do you have one more question in you?
Well, you had asked a couple on here. I guess I would maybe go to the couple of the points that you had raised in your email and just maybe hit a couple of those.
Oh, very good.
You'd asked about the idea of level five in a educational or non-business setting.
Yes, I think that's particularly pertinent in light of your comments about what we see in the coming generation.
Exactly. The more I think about it, and the more that I look at all of our research, and we've been doing it now for about 20 years, and we have about almost 7,000 years of combined corporate history in our research database, but we've also been engaged in looking into the social sector, some work on education and associations and so forth. And the more I look at it all, and including our ongoing research on how to do well in really out of control environments, I keep coming back to the observation that one of the key distinguishing traits or characteristics of those enterprises or institutions that somehow find a way to do better than others and to do better than others over longer periods of time. And whatever, whether it's relative to an educational mission or whether it's relative to a financial mission, I mean, it's really not a business idea. The fundamental question of what are those in power primarily ambitious for is a central question. And what the level five leaders have is an ability or an instinct, or you know, maybe it's something they've had when they were kids. I think it comes in different packages, different paths for different people, but they get to a point where they do have tremendous ambition. These are very ambitious people, but their ambition is channeled outward. It's channeled into some great object that is bigger or beyond themselves. Sometimes it is their institution, sometimes it's their creative work, sometimes it might be a social movement, it might be the company they're building, but their ambition in their ego is channeled into something that isn't about them. And then they use that that ambition for something outside of themselves and bigger than themselves as really the wellspring for two things. One, their own ability to endure the challenges of what needs to be done. And the second being that they inspire others around them, because when you're around people who you see really do have ambition beyond themselves, bigger than themselves, it's not just for themselves, that tends to inspire other people to want to be engaged in their cause. And when I look to the level five leadership, then when you move into educational settings, when you move into social sector settings, what becomes particularly important is how the power map changes. In business, the power map is very concentrated. A single leader can have more power than anyone else and can therefore make things happen. If Sam Walton wants Walmart to go left, it will go left. It was Sam's company. He had concentrated power. When you step into universities, when you step into social movements, when you step into city government, when you step into almost every other sector, the power map is very diffuse. And there are very few people or very few circumstances where one person has concentrated power. What this means is that you have to have what I would call a legislative level five rather than an executive level five. And the legislative level five is the one who figures out how to assemble the points of power to make a decision happen for the good of the overall enterprise or the movement when they do not themselves hold all that power. And this is where the level five is particularly important, because when you are around people who actually are ambitious for the overall goal or for the overall cause or for the movement or for the institution or for the mission, I believe that they can use then not just pure raw power, but the power of coalition, the power of shared language, the power of shared interests, the power of inspired standards as the way to assemble points of enough points of power to get something very useful done. And that to me is, I think, a very special, when you combine that legislative skill set with the level five ambition, I think you get the very best leaders.
Thank you. That is absolutely tremendous. Something that's a much smaller question, perhaps, but that inspired a lot of chatter at EDUCAUSE is the creation of a list of not-to-dos. How do you, in your busy life, manage to weed out those things that are not absolutely essential for you to continue to keep on your to-do list?
I number one, I have a stop doing list, and that helps just to have it. Number two, every year when I sit down and do my annual priorities, and you should never have any more than three primary priorities, but for every primary priority, there has to be a corresponding stop doing. So it's a ledger. It's a balance. It's like accounts. You can't just have assets. You have to have assets and liabilities. And so for every primary priority, there has to be a corresponding stop doing priority, and they have to balance. The third is that I use ranking. So if I'm feeling overwhelmed by lots of things taking place, or we have lots of potential priorities, we'll sit around and rank them. OK, Okay, we all agree these 11 things are good to do. But let's rank order them in importance from 1 to 11. And the interesting thing is that if you do that, most people will agree about what are 8, 9, 10, and 11, and you should just put them on the stop doing list. Rankings are a very powerful way to impose a sense of clarity. And then finally, closing back with Peter Drucker, Drucker had a wonderful question that he liked to ask of people about their businesses, but I think it applies to a range of activities. And it goes like this. If it were a decision today afresh, anew, to begin this activity, to launch this initiative, to introduce this legislation, to start this particular business, given everything you know now, if it were a fresh decision to start it, would you? And if the answer is no, then that's a good candidate for the stop doing list.
Jim Collins, we appreciate greatly your time with us today.
You're very welcome.
An interview with Jim Collins from the EDUCAUSE 2009 Annual Conference. This podcast is sponsored by Juniper Networks and Quest Communications International. Thanks for listening.